Welcome to Art If, the podcast about art, life, and everything in between.
Welcome back to the Art If podcast. This is our 18th episode.
Woo!
I'm Hattie.
And I'm Yossi. In this week's gallery, we talk about art and journey. There's like so many verbs in here. There's so much many mistakes in the sentence. Okay.
Yeah, we need a proofreader.
Yeah. Okay. In this week's gallery, we talk about art and journey. I bring the work of performance artist Pope L to the gallery and talk about how the how of his journey is more important than the distance traveled. Hattie talks about the history of postcards, which takes her on a journey she didn't expect. Then we interview music conductor Nolan Dresden and talk about how music has the power to transport us to faraway places.
And as always, we end with a provocation. This week's provocation asks you to revisit your favorite music and see if it can take you somewhere new.
On a journey, maybe.
Oh!
All right, so this week's theme is art and journey.
Yeah, we picked this because of the way that, well, our guest today is a musical conductor. And so I was thinking mm-hmm. about the way that music can really transport you and take you on these journeys, if you will. So
very cool.
It was, I don't know, kind of a basic thought process, I guess, but I like the idea of journey, and I think that it has a lot of, I thought it had a lot of potential for where we could go in our gallery. So
wow, well, I mean, let's take a journey.
Take us on a journey.
And we both made the same bad joke. All right. And this is why we're friends. Okay. Well, I think I go first this week.
Yes.
So I first started thinking about like art that like went over space, right? Like that, like I was being very literal.
Yeah.
Like art that was a journey. So like the one of the first things that I thought of was like Marina Abramovic and Yule, and when they like broke up, they like walked on the Great Wall of China to like say goodbye, and then they you know, so I was thinking about like moving art.
Okay.
Art that itself goes on a journey. And then I was like, well, I don't want to just do something so like on the nose,
right?
So I wanted to think about what I'm going to talk about is art that is moving, that does deal with movement and is a journey of some sort. But what this artist really does is like, it's the art isn't about the journey, but it's about how he goes on the journey.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to be talking about Pope L. Do you know Pope L?
No.
He's famous for these. No,
okay.
I think it was his middle name.
Okay.
He is a 64-year-old black man that grew up in New York City.
Okay.
He was a theater artist, photographer, and performance artist. And he's most famous for his series of works called Erasism. So like
the play on erase, but
and racism, right?
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And his most famous works are his crawls.
Ooh.
So he does these urban crawls where he's literally crawling in urban space. And so his first one was in 1978, and it was a Times Square crawl. And he said this came out of his visceral reaction to like his aunt and uncle being homeless. And so he talks a lot about how verticality is urban power. So those who are wealthy enough or healthy enough to be able to sort of move in a vertical fashion. And this is a quote he said, people who are forced to give up their verticality are prey to all kinds of dangers.
Wow.
And so a lot of what he talks about in his work is how we get accustomed to seeing people that are homeless or laying on the street or not vertical, but like we either try not to see it or we become used to it. So for him, he wanted to bring attention to it in a way that felt direct. And so another interview I watched with him, he said, you know, I was writing, and it just wasn't making the same points that I wanted. So I wanted to get away from language and just have something that was pure action and was very clear. So his most famous one, perhaps, was the Tompkins Square Crawl, which was in 1992. And he wore a suit.
Hi, Lulu.
Can you hear her?
No, but I can see her knocking over your microphone.
Yeah, so I'm like, don't know if we can hear this. All right. Okay. So.
Now I can't see you.
I know. I'm hoping she'll calm down in a second. So basically, he was wearing this like wool suit, and it was supposed to be like this take on a working man sort of, but like changing the power dynamics. And he's crawling in this wool suit across Tompkins Square Park in the East Village. And this one, actually, somebody stopped him and offered him help.
And
he said, no, I don't need your help. And the guy got so mad that he started a fight with him. And so that crawl actually ended early because he got really angry. And he was like, I have a suit like that. And it was a black man. He was like, what are you doing? You're mocking me. Oh. So in this subversion of power, he was seen by someone who felt that same sort of pressure in a way. Yeah, so his most famous, not his most, but like another really famous one is he did it on Broadway, and it was called The Great White Way. And he did it over the course of 8 years. He crawled the 22 miles of Broadway in a Superman costume.
Wait, so it took him 8 years to crawl that 22 miles?
Yes.
So he crawled a small portion each day and then like picked up where he left off.
Yeah. And I think that there were some breaks. I don't think it was straight. But yeah, he crawled all 22 miles of it over 8 years in a Superman costume with a skateboard strapped to his back so he could get through intersections if he ran out of time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So again, like he really feels, you know, that disrupting. So it is about the length of the journey, but it's, for me, I see the impact of his work of like how he goes about it. So it's like anyone could take a cab the 22 miles of Broadway or take the subway or walk, right? But this choice to crawl and to sort of experience New York on a different level. And he says, you see the insect life, you see the dead matter, you see, you know, piles of leaves and things. And he said, you know, to not move at the same rhythm of the city is a form of resistance.
In New York City, especially, they hate when you're not moving fast enough. They're like very intolerant.
Exactly. And then when you see, you know, this black man in a Superman costume,
you make all sorts of assumptions about what he's doing and don't bother to stop and ask, probably.
Right. Or you have questions and you do stop and ask. I mean, that, you know, I think that having lived in New York, and it's true, like people, there is sort of, you can get irritated if there's like people aren't moving at the pace of things. But on the same way that people keep them to themselves, I actually find that people are also more willing to interact with each other.
Oh, interesting.
Strangers. So like on a subway car, like people would be like, hey, what are you reading? Like that happened multiple occasions to me. Like just sit next to me. Oh, hey, is it good? And like, or, oh, I read that. It's really great. Just, you know, passing comments even. Whereas in places where you're in your car or there's not a lot of public interaction, you don't have those same exchanges. So I think people did ask questions and wanted to know what's going on. I mean, the Tompkins Square crawl ended in almost altercation. So, you know, I think that moving differently on a journey can be a way to resist the powers that be and sort of like challenge the structure. So I was really drawn to this piece because it wasn't just about the length of the journey or the destination, but it was about the how, the process.
Yeah, I really like that. That's really inspiring, too, to think about. Just, I mean, I'd rather parkour than crawl. I mean, I see the point, though, of what you're doing. But, yeah, like, taking taking a different...
Wait, can you parkour?
Well, not really, but I can I can jump on stuff.
Okay. I was like, I'm impressed. I'd like to see this.
I can parkour the same way Michael Scott can parkour. I don't know if you've seen that episode of The Office.
I haven't. I admittedly have never seen The American Office ever.
Okay. That's fine.
Yeah.
I'll forgive you.
Sorry. I know. I'm disappointed to all American culture, but...
finding a different way to sort of interact with the city and seeing the new information that it and the new way it presents that place to you is, I don't know, really nice.
Yeah, and to others, I think that's like a part of it too, right? Like other people consider how the space is made too.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But he definitely says he recommends crawling, so I don't know, maybe give it a shot.
Does he crawl like army crawl or crawl like on your hands and knees
crawl? Army crawl.
Yeah.
And actually his most recent one they did for his retrospective, he says, I have a back injury. So he actually hired 150 volunteers to do this like massive crawl.
Whoa.
In New York. And what was kind of cool is one volunteer like swept the street and then another one put, this kind of goes back to our senses discussion, because they put the scent of like tobacco leaves where the people were crawling, because that's what used to grow in that area of New York. It was like a farm.
Oh.
And then he had like the people crawling blindfolded in that
fascinating
era. Yeah. So he's still finding a way to like disrupt space and movement, even if he physically can no longer crawl. But the images are very stunning if you get a chance to see them.
Cool. Very cool.
So Art and Journey, what are you bringing to the gallery?
Nothing so serious.
Okay.
And actually, it's funny that we made the stupid joke at the beginning, because the way I was going to frame this is that this did not end up to be what I thought it was going to be. I had this whole idea of like why this was going to be cool, and it is not at all related. it's not cool, but it's just like it's a totally different world than I thought I was getting into. It's not even that interesting. I don't know. It's fine. It's interesting. I don't want to hype it up. I'm doing postcards. Let me just.
Oh, yay. You know I collect postcards, right? Like, I'm obsessed with postcards.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I can bring down my postcard collection right now.
Then you're going to maybe answer all of my questions. I'm so confused about collecting postcards.
I'm not like an official postcard collector. Okay. But, like, I have a box of that's what I buy when I travel and go to museums and stuff.
Do you have a favorite?
No, I don't know. I mean, there are hundreds in here.
Do you look at them?
No, but I'll sometimes decorate with them. So I actually, like, have postcards that I've had and have been up on my wall since, like, high school.
How do you pick out a postcard?
So at an art museum, I'll pick out one that was, like, my favorite painting I saw in the museum on that day. And then for a while, instead of a travel diary, because I'm too inconsistent to do that, is I would send myself postcards from the place.
That.
And then you have the stamp from the place and all of that. So that's not a complete collection either, but I still do continue to do that.
Oh, that's so neat.
Yeah. So I'm so excited.
Okay. So I picked postcards because, well... my friend group on Marco Polo has been talking about bucket lists for the last few days. And all I can ever think about when I think of a bucket list is traveling. And so I was like, well, how do you document these travels? And so I landed on postcards. I was like, that's a really cool like idea of journeying. But then I also was thinking about, I really like decided on it because I was like, this is so interesting because you go and you buy a postcard and you write on it and you send it to somebody else. And so somebody else is collecting your journey. And that is like kind of trippy to me. And then you don't have the thing. Right? Like you don't,
right.
Now you don't have the souvenir and like you told about this, how you got this postcard and like now you don't have it. So I just decided to start looking into postcards, and I started with the history of postcards. The first postcard, the earliest known postcard, was in 1840, and it was a hand painted design created by the writer Theodore Hook.
Okay.
And he is believed to have sent it to himself.
Oh, okay.
As a joke. He, in fact, if you look him up on Wikipedia, the bio line is basically like, he is best known for being practical jokes.
That's amazing.
And so
okay.
This particular postcard, if we can call it that, since it's the first one, was a picture that he drew of postal workers.
Oh.
And so it was kind of like satirizing the postal workers. And so he sent it through the mail. That's like a joke to the postal workers. And it's them sitting around like a big inkwell with like these big pens.
Okay. And wait, what year was this?
1840.
Okay. Interesting.
This postcard wasn't discovered as such until 2001 when a stamp collector found it. It bears the black penny stamp. Oh, the penny black stamp, which is the oldest self-adhesive postage stamp.
Wow.
So that's somebody acquired this piece because of the stamp and then discovered that it was the first postcard.
Okay, cool. Well, I imagine that it had to come out of like trading cards or trading pictures. I mean, because I feel like,
You know, there are... No, not really. Well, not what I read.
Yeah, because I would have guessed, like, you know, like, I'm mostly thinking of, like, erotic pictures of ladies that were, like, traded and sort of reproduced, like, in, like, early 1800s. And I feel like there were some of, like, cities and actors and things.
Huh.
So maybe at least there's, like, a some sort of, what is the word I'm looking for?
Well, the erotic picture, the pictures of erotic women are a genre of postcard. So that when that style, that content might have come out of that, but sending something through the mail, at least according to the histories I read, has a different origin for the most part in a mass produced way.
I see. Okay.
It began during the Franco-Prussian War. Is when it really took off, when the government created these postal cards for the soldiers to send cheaply home to their families' communications.
I see. And when was the Franco-Prussian War?
1870.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
So for the most part, what they're considering postcards were largely produced by the government at first. And
interesting.
Processed in this particular way. And then...
Do you think it was also so they could surveil what they were writing, like, in addition to... Okay.
Because there were proposals to the post office to create something that could be mailed in this format earlier, and people shot down the proposals because of the lack of privacy.
Okay.
So I didn't run across anything specifically that indicated that they were surveilling them, but I can't imagine that didn't play into it.
Right.
I mean, yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
In the United States, there is what we call the golden age of postcards. Who knew? Oh.
Is that in like in the 50s?
No, 1890 to 1915.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Primarily revolving around the World's Fair.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, okay.
So these were...
Because those were like these big national building events. I mean, I've read a few books on the fairs for various reasons and various reasons. I'm done today. Yeah, that makes sense because it was about sort of like both creating novelty and sort of... imagining new worlds. So
yeah. And it was a huge marketing ploy. I mean,
oh yeah.
And so creating some sort of official souvenir, and these postcards from the World's Fair would have the line official souvenir on them. So they were really promoting them as a way of advertising.
Interesting. Yeah, the ones I've looked at in the 30s in the archives also, right, they say national and they have like the different, like, and you could buy different collections that had different pictures.
Cool.
Yeah.
Then, of course, the flip side of this is like straight up advertisement postal cards. Okay. Those sort of emerged simultaneously. And I think what's really interesting to me is that when I started thinking about postcards, I assumed that they were primarily souvenir oriented. But if you look at the long history of the postcard, it is tied very directly to the history of printing.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I guess like that makes sense, but it's not something that would have been the first thought to cross my mind.
Right. And so innovations in publishing and printing actually drove the market for postcards in a lot of ways. And they, a lot of them seem to have been intentionally created for sales and not as souvenirs or not as mementos and not as markings of like sites. And so there's just tons of postcards that aren't related to places and spaces. And that kind of like weirded me out because I was like, well, why a postcard then?
Right.
Like, why something? And then the back of the postcard too has gone through a lot of changes and a lot of different kinds of regulations because the Postal Service was regulating the kinds of materials that can be put through the mail, right? And so the one side has to be for address only originally. And then they have switched to this period where there's the split back on the postcard where you have the address on one side and then you write your message on the other half and then the flip side is the picture.
Yeah, and that's what it is today, right?
Yeah.
For the most part.
For the most part. So then I started thinking, then I started looking into postcard collecting.
Okay, great. So, I'm just like a layman collector that it was like a cheap, portable, easy memento because I also move a lot. So I didn't want like mugs or something.
Right. That's big. Why I collect earrings because they're small, perfect. Portable, and affordable.
Yeah. But yours at least are usable. Mine just sit in a box and I don't really look at them. But I do put them on my wall sometimes. I like have postcard collections. I eventually want to like decoupage a table or a wall or something.
Fun.
Yeah, but.
Well, the collecting of postcards is called deltiology.
Okay.
Did you know that?
I didn't know. I'm a deltiologist.
Yeah. So there's some controversy about what really counts as postcard collecting. In its early days, people were staunchly of the mindset that in order for something to count as collectible, it had to have been posted in the mail.
Okay.
And so, and then in the later 20th century, they started being more accepting of collections that were postcards that were simply purchased and put into the collection and were never put through the mail. But part of the original draw was also getting the stamp.
Mm-hmm.
Postcard collecting is the third biggest field of collecting after stamps and banknotes.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought it's original over here. Maybe I should find my people.
You're basic.
Yeah, I guess so.
So I was thinking like, well, why do people collect postcards then if they're not being posted through the mail? Like what? I don't understand. Why not just buy a small illustration or, right? Like why the freaking postcard? So there's this one website that is just a vast, I don't know, what cauldron of information about postcard collecting. Like this person blogs extensively about postcards and all the history. And it was really fascinating and way too much information. So I skimmed a lot of it and pulled out bits and pieces that I thought I could digest. But one of the things that the person does is demonstrates how postcards chart history. And so I read a post about, it was called Where Did All the Sheep Go? And there are a whole bunch of postcards of what is now Central Park that have a whole bunch of sheep in them.
Oh, like Sheep's Meadow, probably.
Yeah.
That's probably why it's called that. I had no idea there were ever actually sheep there.
And so this blog post charts the history of that space And there are postcards from every period in time that show what that space looked like at each juncture of this debate between what this about what this space should be used for.
Oh, that's cool.
There are pictures of it with sheep, and then there it goes all the way down to contemporary times where there's a contemporary photograph of Central Park and people just laying in the grass.
Yeah, that's where you go and have brunch and like drink illegal mimosas on the weekend.
Cool.
Yeah. Or you did 10 years ago. I don't know what you do now. Not that.
And then I read another, or I skimmed another blog post about pandemics. And it was, again, focused on New York City. So I think this person must be located there. But it showed postcards from all these periods in history about pest houses and different quarantine areas and the docks when immigrants would get quarantined when they immigrated. And then it went into this... Well, I just want to, maybe I just can, I'm just going to read this paragraph.
Yeah.
In the wake of the current COVID-19 pandemic, some have been disappointed that the crisis has not caught the eye of many artists. If we look back to 1918 for better examples, we will not find them. While there are countless works based on the horrors of war, there is a notable lack of artistic response to the pandemic that killed many more. We may say that war is hard to fathom, but even if our rationale is faulty, we do understand concepts of patriotism, nationalism, hatred, and the allure of adventure. Oh, because before this, it sort of ends in like ghettos and the quarantining of the unclean kind of thing.
Mm.
It's different with disease.
Like racially unclean.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's different quote with unquote. Disease because it arrives with no moral ideology or purpose. It does not hate us. Nor can it be made to love us. Without a human dimension, we cannot relate to it, only its consequences. It is like it isn't really there. The same argument can be made for postcard publishers who did next to nothing in response to the social upheaval of pandemic brought. When a card can be found, it usually depicts a hospital because they contained a captive audience who were desperate to correspond with family and friends. Profit drove production, not social concerns. And these bland cards are difficult to differentiate from those made in better times.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah. So just a really fascinating look at history through what people see as marketable artwork. The website also goes into detail about the many reasons that people collect postcards beyond charting the history. There's topical postcards that commemorate particular kinds of events or news of the day. So there was a period in time when postcard manufacturers would essentially create headlines that could be distributed that very day.
Oh, that's cool.
Or illustrations of the news events of the day.
Yeah, because so, before the internet, you would send them to somebody who was far away and say, like, oh, this is what happened.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Some collectors focus on collecting postcards of particular subject matter, like the erotic women or ballet or specific sites or something. And a lot of collectors collect postcards by certain postcard artists.
Oh, wow.
And so some of these people have – they're artists and illustrators in other realms – but if they – very few postcards come with an artist's signature. Usually they're produced in this more anonymous fashion. And so there's this subset of postcards that are artist-signed postcards. And I looked some of them
up.
And they're just – they're kind of just random artwork. One lady illustrates cartoon-like toddlers, and they don't seem to – they're just normal artwork, but on a postcard. And so this is where I get confused. Like, why did you put it on a postcard then? Why not just
because
make it out of print?
I think you're a I think because postcards feel more accessible than an art print for some people.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's probably cost too. And it is about the mailing
but
of
like
it, I think, even.
Technically, you're increasing the cost by making it a postcard because you have to print on both sides of the cardstock.
Yeah, but like, what are you going to do with a mini print? There's something sort of quote unquote useful in a postcard because it's meant to send.
except that nobody sends these.
Yeah, but that it's like the art of it. I mean, people write plays on postcards.
What do you mean?
I think Quill wrote a play on a postcard.
Like, literally, no. He wrote it on the postcard?
Literally, he wrote a postcard play.
Oh, fun.
Yeah.
Well, I approve of that.
How is that any different?
Because he wrote on it.
Yeah, wait. I don't know. I mean, do you collect small art prints?
No. I don't collect anything. Does anybody? Anything. I don't know.
Well, I just feel like it's also about the size of it, right? Yeah. Like, I can collect more art on postcards than I can on my walls.
But you never look at it.
No. But I know that, like, I will someday. I have to figure out what I'm doing with them. I mean, they did used to be on my wall in every place I've lived, is I have a postcard wall.
Okay.
But, like, I don't have a place for them yet.
That's fine.
And I realize I didn't, the other thing I collect is black and white photography postcards.
Oh, so you do pick a specific subject matter.
Yeah, well, so mine are either travel related that I mail to myself at the art museum, it's my favorite piece, and then if I really like any black and I have a whole series of black and white photography postcards.
So fascinating.
I don't know, I just think I want art. And I want to be inspired, and I want it there. But I don't have room for it, or I don't have the money to do it that in, like, a large scale. Well, this feels like a small way to, like, hold on to the things that are inspiring or that I was drawn to.
Interesting. So, I send postcards when I travel.
Okay, why do you send them?
Because they're a cheap thing to send to somebody and tell my, I don't know, just say hi so that they get a piece of the journey, I guess. I did one thing. I bought 3 postcards, I think, one time, and I cut them into puzzle pieces and mixed them up and taped them back together so that when they were taped together, the pictures were wrong. And I wrote the message on the back. And then I untaped them and sent them to the person so that when they tried to put the puzzle piece together, they put the puzzle pieces together to see the image, but then they couldn't read the message and they'd have to take it apart and do it again. And I was like,
that's funny. That's cute. I once made Christmas cards. I went and bought New York City postcards and then like did a bunch of like glitter glue on the front and put like Happy Holidays and Merry Christmas and whatnot. But it turned out all of that rubbed off in the mail. So it looked like I just bought the like 10 for a dollar postcards and sent those instead of Christmas cards.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So
now that I know all this about postcard collectors, I feel bad that I cut up those postcards.
Oh, I mean, there's so many. I don't think feel bad about it. But I don't know. I think there's something in the popular element of it. It doesn't feel as, like, heady as art collecting, maybe, or it doesn't feel, like, it just feels manageable to maybe, like, the average person.
Interesting.
I don't know. Maybe there's a mass appeal here, something.
Yeah. Well, so I guess I think I got hung up on this why postcard thing because I started off on this journey, right? That they're related to journeys. Mm-hmm. And if you're not mailing them and they don't have anything to do with where you're going, if they're just like randos, I was like, my whole thesis has been dismantled. So
but they are, they are. No, they're markers of your journey. Even if you don't mail them, like when I look back, I remember when I saw that art in one museum and what year and what trip. Okay. So like in a way you were saying, why would you send this souvenir to someone else? In a way, buying them and keeping them is actually keeping the souvenir.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. But real postcard collectors aren't getting them through traveling. They're sitting on eBay and bidding on these. And building collections. And that's
fair enough.
But we just need to have a different episode on collecting and invite Dave on.
I also agree with that because I do feel a little out of my element here.
Yeah. I have but so I think many that, questions about collecting.
Oh my God. That thing is, I think maybe it is quantity over quality too, perhaps. Mm. Right? I have 500 postcards. You know, I don't know. There's something in that. It's easy.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right. Well, I'm so excited to have learned all of that about postcards.
Good.
And who knew I was a Deltiologist?
Yeah. Yeah. We're so excited to have with us today music conductor Nolan Dresden. Sound like a carnival barker.
Oh my. Step right up. Right. Nolan Dresden is on the podcast.
Come on down.
Yes, my name is Nolan Dresden. I am a conductor, musician, and arranger, and I'm currently living in New York City in Astoria, Queens.
Cool.
Straight to the point. Awesome. Love it.
Straight to the point.
So I was thinking that most of our listeners, I think if people navigate to this podcast as an art podcast, conducting is probably not one of the things that's at the forefront of their mind. So
sure.
Describe for us what you do as a conductor. What's your job in that moment? What are you trying to achieve?
So, you know, what's funny is when it comes down to conducting, that moment of the performance is really kind of the last thing you worry about. It's all the work that you have to really do up to that point. So it really starts early, especially if you're looking at like some of the big boys like Chicago Symphony Orchestra or New York Phil. You start programming concerts really a year out. Mm. And there will often be internal groups of, you know, sometimes there's like a programming committee like I've had that I've worked with in the past. Sometimes there's just the artistic director that has full reign to do whatever they want to do, whether it be, you know, maybe it's specific to a particular month. Like, let's say they want to do all gay composers in June, or maybe they want to do all female composers in March, or, you know, something along those lines where they're really kind of catering that entire month or season around a specific object or person. Cool. Now, there's also the bigger theme that sometimes if they want to, let's say, who was that? I believe it was Berlin Philharmonic a few years ago did every Nielsen symphony. So they did one a month throughout their entire season because he had nine month season. So like maybe the programming is based around that. So that's really where it starts.
So what's your relationship as a conductor to the artistic director?
Sometimes they're one and the same.
Okay.
Yes, it can be. It depends on the size of the institution. Sometimes it's the same person. Sometimes there isn't, sometimes the conductor part isn't even in the title. It is just music director. Okay. Sometimes there's an executive director and they'll be looking at like the full picture and they won't actually be performing at all. Mm-hmm. They'll really just be in the audience every night being like, we need to add a dance component. We need to add something that's more visually stunning. So they're kind of sitting they're actually above the music director as far mm-hmm. as like the big picture moment. The music director and or conductor are the ones that are generally picking the music, picking the season, and then they will take the orchestra through the rehearsals. And then the rehearsals is really, for me personally, the best part, because that's when you kind of get to pull the music apart, and work with the musicians, and they get to hear sometimes things for the first time. If you're doing new works, that's often, especially the big orchestras are always trying to get new works, new artists. They're trying to be like the founders of this new composer that, you know, no one's heard of. Mm-hmm. And so that's really fun. And then the orchestra gets to see the music for the first time, and you know, there's no recordings of it because they're premiering the whole thing. So that's really, for me, the joy is like the rehearsal process and discovering the inner workings. And like every symphony is going to be different depending on who's conducting it or directing it, because some go a really historic route and they're like, well, back in 18 dickety dick when this was first performed, this is the instruments it would have been on, this is how it would have been done. Some conductors like myself like to modernize things a little bit more and will make it a little bit more accessible and maybe get away from the technical side of it or the analytical side of it and really reach into the story. Some people look at what the composer was going through or at that time, like were they fighting an illness, were they married, were they going through a divorce, were they cheating on their wife, you know, something along those lines, that they can find little things in the music, be like, oh, the oboe is the mistress, so we're gonna focus on that oboe like during this
that
part
oboe.
Of the piece. That oboe, those oboes,
they're
always
the oboes. It's always the reed instruments, you can't trust them.
So sometimes it's just if you look at like the bigger structure of work from a composer, you can sometimes see that people influence particular melodic lines that they carried through different works from one symphony to the next. Shostakovich is a huge example of, you really can hear a lot of melodic similarities between, you know, his fourth, fifth, and sixth symphonies. And like, even when you get down to like 12 and 13, you can even hear more. So it's really interesting to kind of look at how, if you look at the biography of the composer, that I think that's kind of fun. And you can really find that in the music, and you can really pull that out in different ways. So that's really it. And then really when you get to the performance, that's just the payoff. That's the easy part, because you've done all the hard work to that point. You've programmed it, you've directed it, you've met all the people you need to meet, you've shaken all the hands you need to shake, and now you just get up there, you take a couple bows, you wave a stick around, and it's done. So the performance is just kind of like the candle, really, on the cake.
Can I ask a silly question?
Of course.
So you used to be a performer, right?
I was, yeah.
Like a musical. Okay, so how does it feel, A, to have your back to the audience during the moment of performance? And B, do you think about your back in the moment of performance and what it looks like?
I don't know if either one of you were a Seinfeld fan, but I believe there was an episode about an orchestra conductor being pantsless backstage because he didn't want to sit in his pants because that's what everyone sees. Oh. And that there is actually some truth to that. I never put whatever I'm wearing on until immediately when I'm walking out to the stage, because you don't want to have like huge creases on like the back of you.
Oh, that's so funny.
But,
okay.
Yeah, the thing is, I have a little bit of resting bitch face. So that's something I'm kind of glad that my face isn't looking at the audience, but that I have had concerts where there's been photographers and they've gotten snapshots of me. I'm like, oh, I think I look angry. But no, it's actually a little bit more, there's a little bit more of an ease that I have over me with having my back to the audience, because like, I don't have to see the looks on their face if something doesn't go well, or if they don't like something, then I don't know, then they just don't clap at the end. And it's like, whatever, it's just somebody not clapping. So, but yeah, it is, I mean, it's still performing. Like, you know, you're still giving, you know, sometimes the performance of a lifetime, but it is, it's definitely very different. I think not being able to see the audience is easier, actually. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. So do you feel like you're performing for the orchestra?
A little bit, yeah. You kind of do, because that's the, from my personal point of view as a conductor, that is the more important connection. Like, if the audience is behind it, they're going to be behind it from the beginning, or they're not. So like, it's going to be hard to sometimes win people over. It happens, especially if you're doing contemporary pieces that people don't know, which I've done a lot of them, sometimes to the chagrin of the orchestra. But sometimes
like, we just want to be light.
Yeah, they're like, we just want to play Beethoven. It's like, no, you're doing weird Indian music because I said so. But no, awesome. I try to focus more on the connection between myself and the orchestra than myself and the audience. The audience, it's the orchestra's job to bring them in. It's my job to rope them in. So if that makes sense.
So like, if you're having an off day, that affects how well the orchestra can play? Like if you're like tired or?
Yeah, you're not really allowed to have an off day when you're up there. You kind of can't, because it's
it's like being a teacher.
Yeah, it is allowed. Exactly. Not allowed. You get up there and you're cranky, they're going to know it immediately, and they're going to respond exactly how you feel. So yeah, it's there have definitely been times I've walked into a rehearsal venue and I've had to go put myself in a corner and like pull myself up and be like, okay, get over yourself. Like, this, you got a 3-hour rehearsal that you got to get through. So pull it up. But yeah, usually it's, but also sometimes if I can't pull myself up, usually the orchestra will. Like, sometimes, mm-hmm. depending on the orchestra you're working with, I've worked with some really fantastic orchestras here in the city. They sense I'm like a little down and they just perk me up. And then it's like a great rehearsal. And, you know, it's just as productive as it would have been if I would have been in a good mood to begin with.
Do you have much control over choosing the members of the orchestra?
It really depends. So if you are in like a contracted position with like a professional orchestra, generally you are definitely in part hiring people. Like, you'll be sitting in auditions. Sometimes you might be like the last person that hears them, but you will definitely kind of get final say of whether they sit in the orchestra or not. There's usually hiring committees. But if you are, like, I've worked with volunteer orchestras where, no, if you want to play, you just come in and your audition might be as much as, can you play this scale? Great, you're in. Like, you're hired. But, you know, it kind of depends. Like, in theater situations, at Timberlake specifically, when we were working together, I hired all of our musicians that we had, and that was solely on me. It just had to be, you know, sometimes it's word of mouth, sometimes it's video auditions, sometimes it's in person. It just kind of depends. But yeah, it really just depends on the institution, if it's a standalone situation or if it's a committee kind of situation.
Cool.
Do you play an instrument?
I do. I play piano primarily. I was actually a professional horn player many moons ago. I was 14.
Wait, what horn did you play?
French horn.
I played French horn.
I think we may have talked about this.
Like, I'm sure we did. How possibly. Could we not have?
Yeah, how could we not? I got my first professional horn playing gig when I was a freshman in high school. Was really, not to toot my own horn, but I was actually,
but go for it.
Yeah, I'm about to go for it. I was a pretty advanced student. I picked it up really quickly. And then my teacher advanced me to her teacher, who advanced me to his teacher. And I ended up actually working with some of the greatest horn players on the planet. Like, I worked with Dale Clevenger and Gail Williams of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. They're legends in their own right. But unfortunately, when I was 19, I decided that I wanted to march drum and bugle corps, if anyone is familiar with drum and bugle corps. And during our final performance, I actually shot my lip out. And I went through 6 months of physical therapy to try and get it back. Well, first it was 3 months of total rest. I wasn't allowed to play at all. And then we did another 3 months of physical therapy trying to get it back, and it just never came back.
Oh,
so that's
gosh.
When I turned to singing. I've always played piano. I started playing piano when I was like 8. But then I turned to singing primarily, and then that kind of turned into conducting.
Wow. And you sing opera also?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I was
musical theater and opera.
Yeah. So I got my degree in opera, but with a theater base. So I did a lot of acting, but I only sang opera while I was in school. Primarily, I did some music theater just because it made me more marketable. But I really wanted to focus on opera. And then my last full-time gig as an opera singer was in China in 2008. I was there for about 6 months, and it was... it wasn't the greatest experience for a multitude of reasons that I don't need to go into. But when I came back, I was just like, nah, this isn't the life for me. This isn't what I want to be doing. And then I kind of fell into the conducting world in New York, and it just kind of went from there.
Very cool.
What is the biggest difference from being like one of the performers or in the ensemble or being somebody who has control of their own instrument, whatever it might be, versus being the one that rallies the troops?
I think the biggest difference is, I mean, everyone has to have a pretty good concept of the big picture of things. But once, if you're playing, I don't know why Parade popped in my head, but let's say you're playing Leo in Parade. Like, obviously that's the lead role. That's a huge role. And you have to really know, I mean, it's about him. The whole story is about him. He needs to understand the arc. But when you're conducting and leading musicians and instrumentalists and singers and through that whole thing, you have to have really the full picture. Mm-hmm. And it's a much, you know, sometimes I remember, like, even myself when I was performing, I'd be like, well, why does it have to be this way? I don't understand. And like the director would be like, you don't need to. I understand. Like, pull it back because
but
I told you to.
That's not really a good director,
though. That's not how people direct.
Like, no. Like, let's actually sit down and talk about this.
So, yeah. I mean, yeah, that's probably, well, yeah, that's true. I mean, it probably wasn't that rough, but it was just like, I don't get it. But yeah, it's, I think you really just have to have and I think you have to go in a lot more confidently about what your vision is of the big picture. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think when you're playing an individual role or an individual instrument in that, there's a little bit more room for you to bend. Whereas if there's a very, and I mean, conductors should be flexible too. And music directors and all those people that are in lead positions, they should also be flexible, because sometimes you might have a pure vision of what you want something to be. You have your first reading with an orchestra. It's like, oh, this person isn't as strong as I thought they were going to be. Mm. I need to change something. So you still have to be flexible, but I think you just have to be a lot more solid. I think you just need to know everything better. I think you just need to know every note on every staff. You just need to know everything. I mean, you just have to know every note on every staff of every page of every, you know, of every book. And it's a tough thing to do, but again, that's why the performance is just kind of like the candle on the cake, because you've done so much work prior to that. That's really just kind of,
yeah. I mean, I feel like as a director, like by the time it's in performance, I'm like, my job's done.
Yeah.
You know, and you're still up there, but like, we've done the work, and if it doesn't stand on its own now, like,
well, it's what the same. It's the same for orchestra conductor. Like, you've done the work. Like, and the thing is even if you've done the work and it's gone well, doesn't mean the shit's not going to hit the fan, like, during the performance.
That's true.
Like, all of a sudden, something might happen and be like, oh, damn, well, that went well last week. I don't know what happened tonight, but, well, there it is.
So, you know, hopefully tomorrow.
You've talked a little bit about you're interested in more contemporary or kinds of pieces of music and maybe less technical, historical kinds of things. What draws you to a piece of music, or how do you go about choosing a piece of music that will take the audience somewhere?
So my, generally what I like to do is I like to really, for me, because a lot of what I've had to do is looking at budgets of who we, like, because sometimes when you have extra players outside, you have to bring in people that won't just do it. Like, I've worked with volunteer groups and I've needed pieces that need two harps. Well, if I'm solid and for sure that I want to do this symphony that calls for two harp players, then that kind of throws me into, well, I'm going to get my bang for my buck on this one. What else can I utilize that also needs two harps? So that sometimes influence, you may have to unfortunately play the game of where's my money going to best be spent. But generally, if I have a little bit more freedom, I really like to pair the known with the unknown. And I did that a lot, especially with the gay and lesbian orchestra here in the city that I worked with. I really tried to pair things that even most of the orchestra members had never heard of with something that I knew they were comfortable with. One of my favorite concerts that we did It was the Shostakovich Overture on Kiergit's Themes, which a lot of them knew, not everyone, but enough of them. And then we did this random Toru Takemitsu chamber piece that called for two harps that, like, no one had ever heard of, and neither had I until I started researching. And I'm like, well, it's easy, it's pretty, it's small, it works. And then we did Copland 3, which everyone in there knew. So it
was
kind of like,
you're going to have to send us the spelling of that so we can put it in our show notes.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, that's fine. I have it all written down.
I'm like, I think I know Copland.
That's cool. I can sound that one out.
But again, you also have to think about your audience. Like, you don't want to put a bunch of contemporary artists that no one's ever heard of on a program, because that's not going to bring anybody in. So
you got to draw them in and then blow their minds.
Right, so if you hit them with Shostakovich and Copland, well, they're going to pay for two of the three. They'll sit through the Takemitsu, but they're still going to love it, because it also had, like, weird instrumentation and, like, cymbals being dipped in water and then being struck, and it makes this really weird shimmery sound. And
cool.
So it's, so, like, that was one of them. We did a concert really early on when I was with them called Postcards, and the whole idea was to be going to different areas of the world. And I still sometimes wonder why I did this to myself. I programmed a piece by a gentleman named Bright Shang. He's a Chinese-American, and he wrote a piece called Postcards. And it's a four-movement suite, and it's all about different areas of China. And it was so weird and so hard, completely atonal, very interesting instrumentation. And the orchestra is like, what are you doing? Like, you should not get, and I'm like, you're going to love this. Trust me.
You're like,
well,
just come with
me. Just
me.
So happened, which I didn't tell them this part, it just so happened that Bright was doing a sit-down residency at Carnegie that same week.
Awesome.
And I was like, hey, Bright, because he contacted me when I programmed it and ordered the music. He contacted me. He's like, no one has ever done this piece outside of China.
Ah!
And I'm like, oh, great. I'm like, well, we're going to do it now. So he's like, can I come in and work with the orchestra? I'm like, oh my God, absolutely. And he came in and he was just so, like, he's hilarious. He's a piss fire, let me tell you. But he was just like yelling at the orchestra, like, you need more bow, do this. And he got up there and he sang this kind of, like, Buddhist hymn out to them to explain, like, why the first movement was written the way that it was. And then
he talked
about, like, the austerity of the last movement, of, like, why it's so sparsely, because the last movement's just creepy and weird. And literally it says at the end of the score, cut off and wait 30 to 45 seconds before you step down from the podium. And the piece just kind of ends. And I just stood there and it was dead silence. No one moved. You could have heard a pin drop. It was amazing. And we got done, and I had several orchestra members came up to me after the concert. They're like, I hated everything about this piece, but I'm so glad that we did it. I'm like, I'll take that. Like, I will take that as a compliment. But yeah, but then we paired that with, I think we paired that with like Mendelssohn or something, like something that the orchestra was really familiar with. So it's like this really, this kind of like, not to be too on the nose, but this kind of yin and yang of music, of like things that really are austere and a little bit troublesome and maybe not as accessible, but stuff that when all said and done, it's going to be, you know, easy and comfortable and everyone's going to have a great time.
Is it totally awesome. Convention that the audience waits until the conductor steps down to clap?
So in theory, in
depends
theory,
on how well-trained the audience
right.
is.
Yeah, well, yeah, and also it really depends on where in the world you are. Because, like, there are, like, if you're in a lot of countries in Asia, they are dead silent for the entire concert. But you go to Germany, you drop your hands between movements, like, and they're, like, super, super loud. And American audiences are going to, like, somewhere in the middle. But generally, if the conductor's arms are up, the audience is to stay quiet, so to say. But, like, also, like, I'm kind of the mindset, like, if you're hearing something for the first time, and we're just finished the second movement, but you loved it, clap. Who gives a shit? Like, clap for it. Like, if you liked it that much, I mean, if you look at Tchaikovsky Symphony 6, in the premiere of the piece, there was a standing ovation after the third movement because it's so, like, big and bold and loud. There was a whole nother 15-minute movement to go. Like, they had to wait for the audience to sit down, and the conductor was probably up there like, okay.
This is like people clapping after every song in a musical, and I hate it. Yeah. I hate it so much.
But, yeah, I don't know. I'm just a little bit more about bringing music to everyone. And, you know, it's there's actually a quote that I kind of go by. Thomas Beecham, world famous conductor in his day, a Londoner, a lot of questionable things in his life, people that he worked with and things that he said and quotes of his. But one of my favorite quotes of his was he was working in the States. I think he was with Boston or Philadelphia. And he was working like a very standard concert, like Brahms 4 or something. And like, I guess they were just kind of like going through the motions and they weren't really into it. And to get them to play it out, he's like, you have to play this piece like someone in the audience is hearing it for the first time. But you also have to play this piece like someone in the audience is hearing it for the last time. And I'm like, Oh, wow.
That just gave me chills.
I know, right? And I was like, wow. I'm like, that is kind of amazing. And ever since I read that, I'm like, that's exactly how I'm going at everything. Like, that's how I'm doing everything from now on. Like, I'm going to get up there. I'm going to create something. I'm going to play something. I'm going to sing something. Because it might be the first time I get to do it, and it might be the last time I get to do it, too. So I think I think that was a really powerful quote by him.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you something that might be too personal, and if it is, you can, like, we can cut it out.
Oh, you don't know,
on your website.
You don't know who you're dealing with here.
Well, you mentioned with the composers how sometimes they put their own life into the art and whether they're, you know, have a mistress or this, and you are very
she
open
wants to
about
know
your
about
battle
your
with
mistress.
Cancer.
Just kidding.
It was an oboe player, wasn't it?
How did you know?
No. Yeah, you're very open about your battle with cancer and leukemia on your website, and I'm just wondering how art played a role in that experience for you.
So it's actually, the way it played probably the biggest role for me. What's funny is when I was admitted to the hospital, I obviously was admitted immediately. I had no chance to go home and grab anything that I needed. The first thing I made a list of was the scores that I wanted someone to bring to me so that I had something to keep that part of my brain active. But I think beyond that part of it, just constantly having a stack of orchestra scores in the corner, whenever I was about to go through a treatment, whatever it was, I would always ask, how long is this treatment going to be? And they would tell me, and I would go into like my mental library of pieces. I'd be like, oh, that's the same length of, or about the same length of time as this piece of music or this entire symphony or whatever. And I always would time their treatment, and I would just put my headphones on. I blocked them out. If they needed to do whatever to me during it, I would just let them go. But yeah, I would time the music with my treatment so that I always could have music running. And the one thing I actually probably listened to the most was probably Copeland 3, because there was one particular treatment that I got a lot throughout my entire chemo regimen that was exactly, like, within 30 seconds, one way or the other, the length of that whole symphony. So I listened to that symphony probably 30 times, if not more, while I was in the hospital. But yeah, that was the thing, and I had kind of my mantras that I would kind of, because I wouldn't follow the score. I have the score to it, but I wouldn't follow the score. I would just, like, close my eyes, kind of have my mantras, work on my breathing, and just really try and find something in the music that I didn't hear before. And that was kind of what kept that part of my brain active that whole time.
That's so amazing. Cool.
Can you listen to it now?
Oh, yeah.
Or what does it feel like to listen to it now?
No, yeah. I bawl like a baby. Oh, no. The PTSD is real. Yeah, I mean, a little bit, like, sometimes. But sometimes, like, silly things happened in chemo or in, you know, in the hospital as well. I mean, I was in the hospital for 10 months. Of course, like, weird things were going to happen and silly things were going to happen. And sometimes, like, even now, I don't really listen to classical music a lot unless I'm specifically listening for research. But every once in a while, like, if my iTunes is playing, like, something will pop up and I'll be like, oh, that makes me think of this particular nurse when this particular thing happened during this, you know, round of chemo or something. Yeah, I mean, it can be a little reactionary sometimes and a little triggering, but generally for good, generally good things.
We talked.
Good. Yeah. Music is, go ahead.
Oh, well, we talked
such a container of memories. That's what I was saying.
Oh yeah. I was going to say, well, we talked a little bit on an earlier episode about how some kinds of music can really transport us and, like, take us to a different place. And we talked specifically about that, like, folky French jazzy stuff. And it always makes you feel like you need a baguette or whatever.
Some good cheese.
I want a glass of wine.
Oh, yeah. Okay, fine. You're right. But I'd love to hear someone who is just so enveloped in music talk about what it is about music that has this ability to take us on these journeys and to really transport us away from whatever moment that we're in.
You know, there's a very common term used in classical music a lot for certain pieces. It's called a tone poem. And it's this thing that's specifically written, and I think the probably most iconic tone poem out there is Strauss's Alpine Symphony. It is insanely long. It is a massive orchestration. Like, I think there's 16 horns off stage during it, do this big hunting call at one point in time, or 8 horns, something like that. But it's just huge. And even if you visually look at the score, it's built like a mountain. You can literally just see it slowly creep up, and suddenly the entire page is black, and then it kind of goes away. And then you can kind of see the music go into, like, this river motif, and then it goes back into the mountains, and then it kind of fades off into the haze. And that's, yes, that is a tone poem, absolutely. But my issue with the term tone poem is I really feel like everything should take you somewhere. And sometimes just a symphony, if you can find a story within a symphony and relate that to the audience, then that can also be like a tone poem. But I think what it is there, I mean, it's been proven that there are just certain intervals that trigger certain emotions, like, just like, you know, bum, bum, ba-dum, like, here comes a bride, that will automatically trigger happiness. There are certain keys.
The fourth triggers happiness?
Yeah, the fourth triggers happiness. The augmented fourth triggers anger, because it's the devil's interval. Then there's also certain keys, like in like old churches, that you weren't allowed to play in because they were considered like the Satan's key. I can't remember what they are off the top of my head. But there's also certain keys that just sit better. Like, for me personally, D flat major is a key that always just kind of like settles me. I don't know why. But then there's also, I don't know, it's just, and I also think orchestration has a big part to do with it, because I think Shostakovich is probably the best orchestrator that has ever lived, because he can write instruments in extreme registers, but because he writes it at the right time, it doesn't seem extreme. So it's like this, it will kind of create this anxiety without overwhelming you. So I think that's where, like, E flat clarinet, like, way up in the rafters is like, ooh, like, it's like a baby crying and like screaming its head off. But it, like, in context, it kind of works, but it still gives you that anxiety a little bit. So I think it just really has to be well, I think it just has to be well written. And I know that sounds like a total cop out, but it really just, there are ways of putting things into music that will just automatically trigger, you know, if you need to trigger, like a weighty, like a dangerous situation, it's always like low, like pedal tones that just kind of like hang out that you may not necessarily hear. You just kind of feel them. Like, you know, it's there, but you don't really hear it. So I think that's really what kind of triggers things. And we're all surrounded by so much music all the time and often don't realize it. Commercials, TV, elevator, waiting room. You know, if you ever really just kind of like take your opportunity to like listen to the world around you, there's always music, especially in New York. There's always some crazy guy driving his car by with his like music blaring. Like that's music that's in your life. You may not like it, but
right. Or even like, I mean, the sounds of sirens. Like I remember when I lived in New York and I'd be on the phone and other people would be like, oh my gosh, what's happening? And I'm like, I'm not even hearing it because you just hear it. Like that's the part of the landscape, the sonic landscape.
Yep.
Soundscape.
It made me think of, I had a sound designer. We were doing a lot of musical accompaniment underscoring for a show I directed. And I gave him a sample and I listed all the things I liked about it. And he came back with 10 samples that had all those things. And I was like, no, none of these are right. And we just had to like keep picking it apart until we found like the one thing that was in there that like made the piece, that feeling. It's so specific.
Well, and there are certain things also that are just triggering because they've been in the human nature for thousands of years. Like if you hear like a good kind of like drum beat, everyone is always automatically triggered to something that's like tribal because we were all tribal, you know, thousands of years ago, but there's still just something about that is kind of triggering. And, you know, there's just, I don't know. I think there's just, we're also exposed to music so early, you know, in different ways that I think by this time it's just human nature.
Cool.
Yeah. So in films and when I've seen conductors live, there's usually like one quirk they have. Like one of them is singing. You can hear them singing one part or there's some sort of strange. What's your conductor quirk?
My conductor quirk.
And it can't be resting bitch face.
That's exactly where I was going to go. It might be crying. I cry a lot on the podium. I don't know if that's really a quirk. No, it's not always bad. Like I get so like into, I kind of black out a lot when I'm conducting. Like when I'm actually in performance, I kind of stop paying attention to what's going on. Well, maybe that's my quirk is I stop paying attention to what's going on.
Well, are you just like floating above yourself, not paying attention, or you're just like,
oh, you know what it is? I dance a lot. I totally dance a lot. I've actually had to edit videos way down that I've submitted for jobs because it's like, okay, you're not a tango queen girl. Like just stop it. Like they need to see you're conducting. But I do, I often get really mobile.
Awesome. You're awesome. Very intense. Like you're very into it for sure. When I watch some of your videos, it's very moving.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. That's very sweet.
I think it's time for the provocation.
Yeah. Okay.
No? We're going to give you a sound effect. Okay.
And this is literally the sound effect.
I love Wayne's World. I'm
second person to get it.
Yeah, of course. Oh, come on. Bohemian Rhapsody, please. Right. So I will say that this is probably the best I could come up with, but I think because it's part of my process in developing a piece of music with a group, my provocation would be to listen to something that you've listened to 1,000 times and find something new.
Oh, I love it.
Okay.
Because, and I'll give an example of something that's not a classical piece. There are a lot of pieces specifically by Panic at the Disco, whom I love, that there are a lot of melodic things that he will sing at the end of the piece that are actually very well hidden at the beginning of the piece, but they bury them down into multiple layers. And with each time the phrase comes back, they bring it further to the front. So then by the time it comes to the end, it's not a surprise because you have heard it, but you didn't know it.
Oh, cool.
Very cool. Awesome. I might have to do that Bohemian Rhapsody since that just came out.
Oh, you'll find stuff.
A million times. Yeah.
I actually did an all a cappella version of that piece once. It was the strangest thing. The guitar solo a cappella was just not great.
I did sing it in a high school choir. I did the alto part. So I always like to harmonize and show off when it comes up on the
record. I sang bass in it like, oh God, probably too many, many, we don't need to age myself.
Many years ago.
We'll just say in college.
All of us saw Wayne's World when we were kids. Right. So it ages all of us.
In the theater.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So, all right. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. It was really nice to
This was a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Nolan, for joining us today. It was so wonderful catching up with you after all these years.
And thanks to all of our listeners. We're doing this for you, and we couldn't do it without you. Want to know more about the cool stuff we talked about on the episode? Check the show notes. They may or may not be proofread.
And be sure to do the provocation. Pull out that favorite song you've been listening to on loop and listen to it again. Pull out a song you've listened to 1,000 times, and this time, listen closely for something new.
And then share what you found with us. We want to know what discoveries you made in your old favorite songs.
And I clearly need to update my playlist, so looking forward to hearing from you.
Yeah, please, please, always need new music. And tag us. Tag us. Tell us what you're doing on ArtIfPodcast, #ArtIfPodcast, on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Sometimes. In our next episode, Yossi and I bring to the gallery art and finesse. And if you're wondering what that's going to look like, so are we.
Yeah, we have no idea. No idea. I have no idea what I'm bringing.
And then we talk to scenic designer Gabby Rooney.
Be sure to rate us and review us wherever you listen. That really helps us out. And hey, you know what? Tell a friend about us. Say, hey, there's these two gals who have a podcast.
Weirdos.
And you should give it a listen. So yeah, that would be great. Thanks.
I love listening to it to start off my day because it is fun. And because it is fun.
Because it's fun and fun. So, and you learn something, maybe. I always learn something. So,
me too.
All right. We're huge nerds. All right. Until the next time. Peace out.
'ArtIf Podcast is produced by
Hattie Cry
and Yossi Jahanmir.
Our theme music was composed by Muhammad Abdul Salam.
Follow us at ArtIf Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook to stay up to date on upcoming episodes and to join our vibrant community of artists.